HD Smartcast.
You're listening to a Hindustan Times production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
We live in the golden age of athleticism. Everywhere around the world, sports people are getting faster, stronger, more explosive. They're recovering from injuries quicker. One of the primary reasons for this is the rapidly advancing field of sports science. Welcome to Secrets of Sports Science, a podcast series into the exciting and ever-changing world of elite sporting performance. I'm your host Rudranil Sengupta, and each week I'll be talking to leading experts from the field to bring you a peek into the makings of a modern athlete. In 2019, during the breathtaking Ashes series, the second test at Lord's, Steve Smith got hit on the neck. A nasty blow from a Jofra Archer bouncer that felled him. Ruled out for the rest of the test, Smith was replaced by Marnus Labuschagne, who came out to bat on the final day of the test. Now, this was a historic moment. It's the first usage of a concussion substitute in international cricket. My guest today is one of the men responsible for the concussion rule introduced by the ICC that year. Dr. John Orchard has been the Chief Medical Officer at Cricket Australia since 2014. He's a professor at Sydney School of Public Health, and he's a pioneer in Australia in the field of sports medicine. When he toured India in 2007 with the Australian cricket team, the concept of a team doctor in cricket was still a novelty. A former journalist, his 4 decades of work in sports medicine is rich, varied, and path-breaking, leading to rule changes in Australian rugby, Aussie rules football, and in cricket, with increased player safety in mind. He also steered Australian cricket through the challenges of the pandemic. Dr. Orchard, it's great to have you on the show. Is it true that you were once called Doogie Howser?
Yeah, that is actually very true. Nothing to do with cricket. That was my nickname when I worked with the Sydney Swans in the AFL in the mid-1990s. I was pretty young at that stage. I was only in my late 20s, and I looked like I was even younger than that. So that was my nickname. You've done some good research, because I haven't been called that for many years.
Right. And from there, it's been such a wonderful and rewarding journey for you in the field of sports medicine. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, look, it's now a fully fledged specialty, and I took a punt going into sports medicine. There was a training program set up in Australia in the early to mid-90s. It had just come about, and a lot of people said, look, don't do this because it's not a real specialty, and you could be going into an area that doesn't really exist. But it certainly has emerged over the last few decades as an important new specialty in medicine. So I've been lucky with the choice of career, and very aware that, you know, there's a lot of luck involved. Hopefully I've done a good job, but I've been right place at the right time. And also, it's probably fair to talk about, you know, we now are taught to respect that if you're white, male, go to a private school, all those sorts of things, you probably have advantages in life that allow you to get to positions like I've gotten to. So I'm also an important, you know, believer in advocating for equal representation amongst different races, amongst females, because maybe I've got to where I am today because of a few advantages that I've had, which is good. But I couldn't say I've loved every minute of it, but it's been a good career.
Right, because of course there's been ups and downs, and it's so stressful. It's like being on a doctor on a war field. You know, like the kind of injuries that players can get, and having to get them back on their feet. I know that you stapled somebody's forehead wound once on the field.
In a rugby league state of origin match. Yeah. Look, one thing I'd like to say about sports medicine is that there's not as much pressure as in other areas of medicine, but there's more scrutiny. So I wasn't on the field when Steve Smith got hit, and superficially, making a diagnosis of concussion in a player who is not 100% and has been hit in the head and has symptoms, superficially that's very easy. And I liken that moment to say a a 2 meter putt to win the US Masters. In that, you know, a 2 meter putt's an easy putt for a professional golfer, but when you've got millions or billions of people watching you, then suddenly the 2 meter putt's a lot more difficult. So if you're the doctor ruling out a player for the first time in a test match, for you know, to be able to get a concussion sub, and it's Steve Smith who's the best batsman in the world at that stage, then the scrutiny is unbelievable, and the pressure's much more than, and you wouldn't want to compare it to a surgeon who has to save the life of a someone who's been injured in a car accident, because it's more of a life and death incident in many of the occasions that doctors who work in the hospitals have to put up with, but.
Right.
When they do that, they're not doing it with the eyes of the world on them. So if you're in an operating room, you've got a couple of nurses watching you, and you might have a family member that's in a room outside or whatever. But you're doing something very important, but without as much scrutiny as we have in sports medicine. So our work is superficially easier, but. It's very similar to the work of the players, in that hitting a cricket ball sounds like it's a fun job to do, and it should be a pretty easy job that you just go out with some of your friends and try and hit a ball around the park. But when you are playing with millions of people watching you, it's actually quite a difficult career in that sense, that the weight of expectation, and it's only growing larger with social media, that everyone wants to comment on your performance every day if you're a professional athlete. And if you pull a player off with a concussion or with any other injury, you'll have people on social media saying, oh, the doc should have let that player stay on, or, you know, you should have taken him off earlier. So a lot of our job, and the pressures of our job, is dealing with the fact that so many people will comment on what you do.
Right. I remember being in the newsroom on the day that Steve Smith was replaced, and I think the general feeling was, at least from my point of view, was that people were actually quite happy that this rule was finally introduced, because I think the feeling was that it took some time coming in cricket, because we had this in other sports already, and it was good for us to see that, okay, there was something that ICC has done that is definitely going to help player safety. And you know, watching Smith fall like that, we wouldn't have wanted him to carry on batting with an injury. And it was a relief, actually, to see that rule was in place and it was working. So it did take a lot of time for cricket.
Yeah, look, it was a lot of lobbying in the background, and certainly stressful, because there were a lot of people who initially resisted it. And I certainly understand the resistance, because cricket is maybe has been the last gladiatorial sport, where it's 11 on 11 and then you sort of... You know, if you lose a player with injury, the player then has to try to carry on and keep playing. And that's still the case. If you get a broken hand, a batter will come out and try to bat with a broken hand, so the team's not one short. And it's an interesting debate about whether you should get substitutes for other injuries. Once we started to respect concussion as an injury with a point of difference in the sports medicine world, that players shouldn't have the ability to carry on whilst concussed. We certainly allow players some autonomy if they've strained a hamstring and they want to keep playing with a strained hamstring. We think that players have got an ability to say, yes, I want to keep pushing through this. And it's not the place of a doctor to say you're not allowed to, that it's quite reasonable. But we certainly learned from the football codes that we have a special responsibility, that we should be yanking players from the game as doctors if they are concussed, that it's not something that you should have the right to be able to continue, because it's not safe for you, and you're potentially in a vulnerable situation that you shouldn't be in. If your reaction time's down, you shouldn't be facing fast bowling, etc. So once there was pressure on us to remove players, then I think there was pressure for a concussion sub to come in. And I have to say that we got lucky in international cricket, that Steve Smith obviously didn't get lucky, because he's not very happy when he gets concussed. But the fact that Marnus wasn't in the side and was a perfect replacement. It was almost like it's like Neil Armstrong landing on the moon. Everyone remembers the first time, but it was almost the perfect like for like. You couldn't have had a right-handed batter who bowls a little bit of part-time leg spin, who's not a bad fielder, who's got quirky mannerisms. It's almost like Marnus was the Steve Smith mini-me.
And it helped that he scored so many runs.
certainly, yeah. Justin Langer's happy that he came in, or because he went on to be a permanent member of the side. At that stage, obviously, he was a fringe member. But the feeling was if a non like for like substitute came in and it changed the nature of the game. And there were all sorts of fears of, oh, what if it's a spin bowler and you don't have a spin bowler of the same type? Can a left arm orthodox come in to replace a leg spinner? And all these sorts of questions were being raised about why this rule wouldn't work. And then the first time it actually happened in a test match, you almost had this photocopy of a player that looked almost identical, and everyone thought this is a true like for like replacement. And then it's a good rule. And now we're sort of more accepting, I suppose, that generally we haven't had too many incidents where there's been a non like for like. But at domestic level, you might only have one or two other players in the change room, and certainly that's actually of interest. I think in England they are much more rigid on the definition of like for like. So if you don't have a spin bowler of exactly the same type, they won't let you have the sub. Whereas I think in Australia we had a game a month or so ago where they let a left armer come in for a leg spinner, for example. And these are interesting debates about what's a permissible sub and how many can you have on the bench, because touring sides have got less access to subs than, say, the home team can pull in all manner of players. But, yeah, we got lucky because it was seen as being a perfect example and went overnight from maybe 50% of people in cricket thought it was a good new rule and 50% didn't, and then overnight went to 90-10, that 90% of people thought, yeah, this is a good rule and we should keep it. And then as it turned out, I know we don't want to talk too much about COVID because we're all sick of it, but we sort of were almost forced to have a COVID sub, even though we haven't used it really much. But when the public health rules came in that you are not allowed to attend a cricket match while sick, there was always going to be the possibility, and I don't think it's happened yet, but that someone on day three of a test match would get COVID and have to be subbed out because you literally are not allowed to leave your home or leave your hotel if you suddenly get a COVID diagnosis. Well, I suppose the fact that it hasn't happened is a testament to how generally the bubbles have done a good job, that people aren't tending to get COVID on day three because they're not going out to a restaurant or a nightclub on day two and picking it up. So, it will be interesting as to whether there's any pressure, and I don't want to be the guy this time, but whether there's any pressure for substitutes for broken hands or other big traumatic injuries of the like, whether that comes into the game over the next decade.
So, I mean, it's interesting, this distinction that you made about other injuries vis-a-vis concussion and players having the right to kind of decide whether they want to play on with that kind of an injury. Because with most other physical injuries, a player more or less knows what the risk that he's putting himself or herself in. Okay, so maybe I need a surgery or the hamstring injury needs like a month of recovery and whatever, but I'm going to still play on. But with concussion, the person who is concussed usually has no idea about the nature of the injury or the depth of the injury, and most people who are concussed will say, no, I'm fine, I'm just going to keep going. So then the onus then comes to the medical team.
Look, it's certainly an injury where the lawyers might even argue you don't have capacity to consent to the, that if you've got a torn hamstring, you can consent to taking further risk. But the nature of concussion is such that if your brain is not functioning fully, that you then don't have the ability to legally give informed consent to go back on the field. So the other advantage we've got in cricket is that with respect to concussion and concussion subs and having that as a unique rule, is that it's almost impossible. I wouldn't say it's impossible. It's almost impossible to fake being hit in the head, and it doesn't happen all the time. So there is a bit of an accusation. In Australia, we have multiple football codes, and there's concerns that concussion subs are faked in the football codes because incidental contact of a tackle, sort of brushing against someone's head, etc. There's not a lot of proof that it's happened, but there's certainly talk and gossip in the codes that have upper body tackling that a tired player might sort of be wanting to get a rest and be replaced by a fresh player. And if there was a tackle that sort of brushed past his head, that the trainers on the field can pull him off and say, this guy needs a concussion test because didn't you see that tackle that sort of almost got him in the head? Whereas in cricket, it's an unusual event. Certainly, we sometimes can have games where two or three head impacts happen, but it's not something that you can routinely fake being hit in the head. So the concussion sub probably in the end has gone smoother than we thought, but it would be a rocky road for having general injury subs because most injuries occur to fast bowlers, and in Test cricket, for example, it's a legitimate part of the game that the job of the batsman is to wear the bowlers out and try to have the bowlers getting more and more fatigued so they can't keep their line and length, and then the batters can score more easily. So the idea that a bowler who was starting to cramp up in the hamstring and then said, look, I think my hamstring's gone, I want to get a sub now, and a fresh bowler came on, I think that batters wouldn't like that, and it would be, it would be interesting to see if substitutes creep in by increments, because I think that there'd probably be more acceptance if someone did have a fracture of their hand or a fracture of a foot bone, or someone had their toe broken. There'd be more potential acceptance that would be a legitimate sub. But if a fast bowler tore a hamstring after bowling 26 overs, then the batters who seem to rule the rule the world in terms of making the rule changes in cricket would say, look, if I've managed to tie that bowler out and the bowler's injured in their 26 over, I want to be facing a fatigued, injured bowler rather than someone who gets to come on fresh. So it is a really interesting debate as to how substitutes can affect the dynamic of the game. But so far in concussion, it hasn't seemed to have had that effect, which is terrific that it's been accepted.
So what kind of research did you rely on when you were making your presentations to the ICC to try and get this rule adopted? Was it from cricket or was it from other sports? Because of course there's a lot of concussion research now starting to happen in different sports, in boxing, in American football and things like that. So the conversation has begun, which used to not happen before. So what kind of research did you bank on?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. The culture of a concussed player continuing in the game, that was changing in the mid-2000s. And in the football codes, it was basically seen as being unacceptable that a concussed player could continue. So that change in culture in the football codes, which was happening simultaneously, that all Australian sports fans were witnessing, was occurring. And then we also had the tragic episode of Philip Hughes being hit and unfortunately dying after an incident on the field. And
you were on the field that day. You were the unsung hero who tried to give him a chance. You did CPR.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very tough day. And anyone who was on the field that day, I think, was affected for a very long period afterwards. It probably meant that in Australia, there was already a little bit of a push to saying, well, concussed player shouldn't continue. But I think if Australia has been seen to have led that evolution of a concussion sub, the extra thing that pushed it along a bit was that terrible tragedy, that there was suddenly a much greater respect for the dangers of fast bowling, and clearly it's super rare. It's a sort of, you know, a one in a million or less sort of likely event, and immediately there was moves that have gone ahead where neck protectors have been added to the helmet, which was obviously very important. But in the aftermath of that, and we did have a lot of we had coronial inquiries, so the coroner had an investigation into that death and whether anything more could have been done. And we had internal inquiries, and Cricket Australia held an internal inquiry before the coronial one. So one of the things that Cricket Australia did instantly was that they gave doctors. Well, we already had doctors at all games at elite level in cricket in Australia, but gave doctors the authority to pull players from the field. And then when we started using that authority, that's when the discussion about having a concussion sub arose. And in fact, another game that I was at, which was you know, pivotal in the history, there was a player who's fairly well known, Ed Cowan, who was an opener for Australia in Test cricket for a few years. He was playing for New South Wales. Yep. And I pulled him from the field with a concussion. That was, you know, a bit like the Steve Smith one. It was maybe even a bit worse. It was pretty obvious that he'd been hit. He wasn't right. He'd staggered a bit, and he actually was looking like he wasn't right on the field. And I came out and said that he had to come off, and he had a big argument with me and said, "I'm not coming off. I refuse to leave the field. It's not fair. You shouldn't have the right to take me off." We actually had an argument on the pitch. And it was only about an over or two to go in the game that day, and the umpires called called stumps early because they didn't want to have it wasn't a palatable situation where you had a doctor and a player having a fight on the field with an over or two to go, and the non-striker I think was almost in tears, the bowler was almost in tears, and they called it off. And and that was on day three of a first class game, and in day four, I'd made it very clear overnight that I wasn't going to permit him to come out and play because he was concussed. And that I think was the day that the players started to have a discussion about, well, if the doctors pulled the player off the field, and I think that people said, yeah, this is the doctor doing his job. You know, he should have the right to stop a concussed player going back out there. But the player did want to go back out there, so why is the team now going to have to bat one short? And I think that's when the players started to have that discussion. And that was, I think, about 2016, maybe early 2016. And then Australia was allowed to bring subs into white ball games the following season, which we did, and we started using them. But the view was that a first-class game, you weren't allowed to have a sub in, and it took a year or two or a season or two before the ICC allowed domestic organisations to trial concussion subs without losing first-class status. And I think the reason why, I think the opposition, which was Western Australia in that game that Ed Cowan was batting, the opposition in a show of great sportsmanship, and I should actually give Adam Voges the credit that he was the captain that day and offered a substitute to New South Wales. And the only reason why it wasn't taken was that the umpires thought that the game may lose first-class status under the rules at that time if a substitute had been brought into the game. So, you know, we sort of moved the needle each season, that we started substitutes in white ball games, and then we eventually were allowed to trial substitutes in red ball games. And at about that time, England and New Zealand also were bringing substitutes in games where they were allowed to. And then once it had 2 years of or two seasons of some domestic leagues having successfully used substitutes for concussion,
Very interesting. And it makes sense that the ICC, what you said about the ICC following due diligence and checking it out first for the domestic games. Wonderful. You and Ed go on fine now?
yeah. No, well, Ed was pretty good from maybe the week afterwards. Yeah, he was. But it does go to show that they're the sort of things that you need to get the balance right as a doctor. If you're always fighting against players and coaches, you won't survive. But if you're never fighting with players and coaches, you're not doing your job properly. So you have to at times make decisions that are unpopular in the dressing room. It's another interesting question too. We're getting by with doctors being team doctors in cricket, quite reasonably. But there's a lot of a push in the football codes to say that independent doctors should be making the decisions about concussions because the teams can't be trusted to do it themselves. But again, I don't think that we've got that push just yet in cricket because the concussions, fortunately, a little bit more of a obvious incident in cricket. So the idea that doctors might be helping to cheat the system for the benefit of their team in football, we haven't seen that in cricket. So there's also been a push with the combination of concussion and COVID. There's also been a push now in cricket where we're about to, I think, hit a level of professionalism where all travelling international teams will have doctors on staff with them, which again, 5 years ago, it was only a minority of teams were taking doctors on tour.
Yeah.
But now, and I think that concussion was the first reason why you might take a doctor specifically.
So making these unpopular decisions, the scrutiny that you're under, it's something that we started this podcast with. I just wanted to know, does it still feel the pressure of making these decisions, or has it gotten easier over the years? And how did you handle it when you first began? When you had coaches screaming at you, or maybe, and you know that, okay, this is going to be really unpopular, but I need to do this. How did you handle
it? Yeah, it's a really good question, and I think that again, I've maybe survived in elite sport by being lucky enough to have gotten away with it. Because I think it's something that if you're a young doctor trying to get into sports medicine, it's probably the discussion that doesn't take place enough to, speak to young doctors to say the hardest thing about this job. And obviously, if you work in a cancer ward, everyone thinks, well, you're going to eventually have a family that you have to tell your loved ones passed away. And I suppose that's a little bit more a part of the job that if you go to work in oncology, you expect to do it and you're mentally preparing to do it. Whereas
right.
I don't know that doctors working in sports medicine realize how difficult it can be at the start. But when you've done it multiple times, you sort of get, I know it's a bad thing to say, but you sort of almost, can tolerate the bad looks. If at the best of times you get bad glances, and on occasions you might actually get abused by a player or a coaching staff member, it's a bit of work we've got to do with culture that eventually we would like to get to the point where if a coaching staff member did abuse a doctor about a decision, that it would almost be similar to if abusing an umpire, that you'd order, you'd get a 3-game suspension, so you just wouldn't do it. It's certainly one where.
But till that happens, just grow a thick skin.
Yeah. Well, it's a little bit. It's interesting how there's different cultures in different sports, but yeah, you do try to change culture. There's certainly a culture, for example, in cricket, where our players are pretty good out on the field. Like our culture is pretty good compared to other sports of players not having tantrums on the pitch. They're pretty good at biting their tongue and walking off. But then the other side of that is in the dressing room. You can get a player come into the dressing room and absolutely go off his head or her head. But the female players tend to be a little bit more reserved and But you know, some of the batters that get dismissed will then absolutely go ballistic, throw objects, abuse people, etc. So the dressing room is an environment that does tolerate tantrums a little bit. And part of that may be that cricketers have been well brought up in a sense that they're pretty well behaved on the field. You know, that compared to the antics that some of the football players might go on with on the field, cricketers are pretty good as a general rule at you get the decision. And you know, even in cricket, cricketers will get if they just pause for 1.5 seconds before they walk off, they might get a level one descent. They may not have said anything, but just the fact that they glared and you know didn't walk immediately, that's a faux pas in cricket, which is when we think about it, it's a tremendous level of control that you get a disappointing decision that you think is wrong, and even if you hesitate before you walk off the field, that's been seen as being bad. But perhaps the biting of the tongue on the field, that you don't have the tantrum there, means that you go into the dressing room and the environment inside the dressing room is a little bit more heated, where you don't have the camera on you. So you've got to respect the dressing room culture, but you want to try to change the culture too. And I think it's changed sufficiently that I'd be surprised if a doctor got sworn at for ruling a player out with concussion, for example, in this era. But I wouldn't say that didn't happen 5 to 10 years ago, because you know the original culture in cricket is it's the player's decision. The player can, if the player wants to play on, he or she gets to make that decision. And in over a 10-year period, as doctors, we took that away from them. But we did it off the back of that happening in the football codes, and it's happened for very good reason in the football codes, because they do seem to have a bigger problem. I'm not saying we probably haven't looked at it enough in cricket as to whether there are any long-term issues with
long-term effects.
What we can say in cricket, which is nice, is that you might get hit in the helmet once or twice a season in cricket, whereas you might get tackled in a high tackle in say the rugby codes or American football or Aussie rules, you might get a brush to your head, you know, 5 or 6 times a game.
But just every game, exactly, yeah. five or six times a game, yeah. Or if you're playing football, then you're heading the ball
exactly,
as well.
Yeah,
so that's
yeah.
That's repetitive stress injury on to the brain. That doesn't happen in cricket.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what we don't know, and again, we need to do further research in that area. Is it the effects of 3 or 4 severe concussions that cause brain damage, or is it the effects of 1,000 minor head impacts?
Yeah.
And in cricket, you might have a player might get 3 or 4 heavy concussions in their career, but they're not getting the 1,000 minor head impacts on a week-to-week basis. And does that make cricket safer?
Right.
We presume it is a chance to make it safer, but again, we probably haven't done the brain biopsies of players when they die in the 60s, 70s, 80s, etc. And that might be research that gets done over the next 10 years. And hopefully the answer is good. I'm superficially, I don't think that we have a big, it's not like we've got anything the equivalent. And they talk about the England World Cup winning team of 1966 that they say that half of them have got some sort of dementia
exactly,
or brain damage or whatever. I don't think that there's an equivalent in cricket, so there's not the same calls to do that research in our sport. But fortunately, even before that research has been done, we're taking concussion seriously and saying that as part of the sporting landscape, which is changing, we're saying it's not right for someone in any sport to play concussed. And it's good that, you know, in the absence of proof that there is long-term damage in cricket, and we don't have proof either way, the sport has been good enough to make that culture change and to say, yes, we will support doctors pulling players off the field if they're concussed. And the players now probably think that whereas they initially resisted having the decision taken out of their hands, they now probably all, in a sober moment, when they're not the one being pulled off, they all probably say, "Now, yeah, that's for our own good, and we think that that's been a change for the good."
Dr. Orchard, we had ambitious plans of talking about lumbar injuries to fast bowlers. Unfortunately, we have run out of time because of this fascinating and very important conversation on concussion in cricket. Thank you so much for your time, and that was really very insightful and a wonderful brief history of concussion in cricket. It was amazing. Thank you so much.
Yeah, look, I'm glad. Hopefully, sometimes, if any Australian cricketers listen to this, I've got a reputation for talking for long periods of time. So if I have a nickname now, it'll be something along the lines of "the guy doesn't shut up." But yeah, sometimes it's better to do one topic in depth than it is to do multiple topics superficially. So I'm glad you ran with it and decided that let's pick one and go into it in a bit of depth. And I understand that one of my colleagues, Renee Ferdinand, she's done a podcast with on bowling biomechanics and the lumbar stress fracture area. Maybe you'll get someone else, or maybe we'll get a chance to do the fast bowler injuries. But yeah, the concussion one is interesting. And the funny, I'll finish off by saying, two or three years ago, people were sick of listening to me in Australia on concussion. And now, it might be something that people don't mind talking to me about concussion, because at least it's not COVID, because that's the thing that everyone's sick of now. it was good that we didn't talk about COVID, because that's hijacked everything in recent times. So going back to concussion, it's almost like that's a breath of fresh air that we're talking about something that's medical that's not COVID. So
Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, all right, no, it's a pleasure.
And I hope to have you again on the
show. Yeah, okay, no, it's been a pleasure going into the topic, and thanks for letting me talk at length on the issue. Lovely to be part of it.
This was an episode of Secrets of Sports Science. I'll be back next week with a new guest. Until then, if you have any questions, you can write to me at rudranil@gmail.com. That's rudranil@gmail.com. For the latest updates on this podcast, do like and follow at HT Smartcast on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and LinkedIn. To listen to more such podcasts, log on to htsmartcast.com.
This was a Hindustan Times production, brought to you by HT Smartcast. HT Smartcast.